When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me, as always, is my better half, Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
Really good, Mark. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. I am glad to be here talking to you about games. We're going to be talking about the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter, and our feature game this week, which is Witchstone by Martino Chiacchiera and Rainer Knizia, our favorite designer.
Our favorite.
So, Walker, what did you play last week?
We got to play The Cure. You taught it to us on Tabletop Simulator.
Well, Pandemic The Cure.
Pandemic The Cure.
We did not play the band fronted by Robert Smith.
We did not. We could have played it in the background. That would have been interesting.
See, the thing is, I have all these puns related to The Cure and Pandemic The Cure. Like, as I commented on the live stream, because we live streamed it, I did have an elaborate series of names for the diseases that all connected to The Cure songs or albums, like, for example, The Red Disease was Disintegration. And, you know, they got more clever from there. Not that, you know, calling it Disintegration isn't super clever. The very height of erudition. But anyway, nobody seems to care. I'm not even super big into The Cure. I don't have anything against them. Anyway, you were talking about Pandemic The Cure.
I thought it was very interesting. I like how they boiled down the essence of what is Pandemic, and they turned it into this very interesting, because, you know, rolling dice is fun.
Yes.
We didn't get the actual tactile feel of rolling it because of Tabletop Simulator, but you sort of, you know, got the, you know, knowing how, you know, press your luck type game, specialized dice, specialized abilities, so, you know, you're getting, you get to do your own little thing. I thought it was really neat.
I like how the smaller number of geographical areas kind of reduces the emphasis on getting from point A to point B. So there are a lot of rules that just aren't relevant. So, for example, research stations and the like, and getting to a research station or using a research station to bootstrap your movement just doesn't exist. I don't object to those elements, but it's nice to see Pandemic kind of shorn of those elements. And you also get an uneven distribution about where disease is going to show up, and that's very clearly represented on the region discs. But you're right. I think that the translation to digital form loses a lot of its charm, because rolling dice is very fun, and Pandemic The Cure, especially once you have experimental meds, the expansion into it, is swimming in different kinds of custom dice. And just being able to play around with all of them, it's surprisingly a large part of the appeal. Not that I disliked playing in digital form. I very much wanted to introduce this to Dewey, who is probably amongst our circle the biggest appreciator of Pandemic, and you have sworn off regular Pandemic forever and always. And
In spirit, mostly.
But I really like The Cure, and I'm surprised that both you and Dewey had not tried it yet.
Yeah, well, I did a long time ago. I did try it once.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was mistaken.
And there's a lot of decisions to make while you're there, because you've got all the diseases. Once you've cured them, they go into the center, and that slowly builds up. Then there's your special abilities. There's putting stuff in vials. There's teleporting people around. There's all sorts of things, lots of decision space, things to figure out, you know, making sure that doesn't build up the middle so it doesn't explode. I love it. It's good.
I'm a large fan of almost all of the Pandemic versions that I played. Actually, the Legacy versions are probably my least favorite, all told, with the exception of the Cthulhu version, which I think was mostly just a misstep. And The Cure I find very, very delightful. It solos really well, far better than normal Pandemic, because then you have to manage multiple hands, and that's something about that bothers me for solo gaming. But I have soloed Pandemic The Cure many a time, because it's quick to set up, quick to play, and you get to play with different characters, and that's always neat.
Yeah, it's designed by Matt Leacock, surprisingly, and put out by Z-Man Games. And like you said, it played so quickly that we played yet another game on our normal Saturday morning Twitch stream. We played Fairy Tale, which was completely 100% scripted right up to the scoring and everything else. And that was so fast, we played it twice and just reminded me of how fantastic Fairy Tale is.
So seldom, and I don't know why this is, but so seldom in other drafting games do you have the opportunity where you're looking at your hand of cards and saying, I would kind of like this card, but here's this other card that my opponent to my right or left, depending on where you're drafting, would really love. What do I do with the situation? And that kind of tension and that kind of trade-off is so often absent. When I play other drafting games, I almost always just take whatever I want most and I completely ignore what everyone else has.
I think it's because it's so tight. Thinking about it, it's so tight, and other drafting games just let you outscore your opponents. Regardless if they get what they want, you get what you need, and you just try to outscore them. This, you can really make a difference with hate drafting.
That end, you draft five cards and only play three of them. So the opportunity cost of taking a card that you don't want to play is much, much lower. And I'm actually surprised that more drafting games don't do that. Because it's such a simple and straightforward way to increase card flow and decision angst without any rules overhead. And we've been playing Fairy Tail ever since it came out, and we're huge, huge fans of it. Sadly, the AI in the Raimund Flame tabletop simulator mod is not particularly good. I've commented on this before. But other than that, it's fabulous. We were showing it to Dewey, and again, Dewey hadn't played Fairy Tail before, but he was immediately struck by the quality of the implementation. And I'll keep repeating it. What I want out of a scripted mod, or indeed any mod or any adaptation, is I want to be able to just click on a card to play it. I don't know why this is so complicated, why in so many other even first-party adaptations, when I booted up the Warhammer Underworlds first-party app, and they were telling me that in order to play a card, I needed to drag it up the screen, I almost vomited in pure disgust. That might be a slight exaggeration, I don't know.
And I'm surprised, they still haven't changed that yet. Like, I do not believe the clunkiness of that Underworlds app.
Yeah, I mean, Tabletop Simulator kind of gets a bit of a pass because of how it works, but I'm still amazed that there's no default notion of a simplified way of playing a card. You know, you've got these mods and these setups such that they're meant to accommodate a very, very common procedure, i.e. taking a card and either putting it to a play to be played later area or to a hand or to a discard pile, and it's always this laborious process. Anyway, Fairy Tail is a joy. It is probably one of my favorite filler-length games. It is probably my favorite pure drafting game. And it definitely puts other things to shame of a similar length and weight, like Fantasy Realms, which, again, is a natural comparison class only by virtue of them both having excellent adaptations by Raimund Flame. And I really think that if you haven't played a quality drafting game yet, and you haven't really found one that sings, I encourage you to track down a copy of Fairy Tail and give it a shot. You might be very surprised.
It's designed by Satoshi Nakamura and published by Z-Man Games.
So hell froze over.
It did.
Pigs flew.
It was very cold.
Finally, you got your copy of Plantopia. I'm, of course, referring to the fact that for months now, I've been hearing from Walker in Pledge of Indifference about how Plantopia is going to come any day now. Like the veritable Godot, we've been hearing about Plantopia. And it finally arrived.
And Mark, were the puns worth the wait?
I have to say that the puns were so good. So each card in Plantopia is a plant, and the plants are an aggressive series of pun. Some of them are very straightforward, like the trigonometry, which is a tree with a triangular arrangement of leaves. My favorite of the puns, because we could just spend the entire episode talking about our favorite puns, so I'm going to limit myself to two. There's the trigonometry. My favorite one is the carnation. The carnation is a flower with a flag of a car growing out the side. And the flavor text says, the carnation is a nation full of cars. What can I say? It appeals to me. We were just, the entirety of the game, as cards were being dealt out, every once in a while we'd look down and either groan or snicker. And the pictures are adorable, above and beyond the actual puns. They're very, very cute. All your action cards are keyed to your whatever vegetable or fruit you happen to quote-unquote be. I was the banana, so there was a picture of the banana suntanning with its peel off. Anyway, it's so cute.
This all being said, it's a very nice little light game. You're growing your plants. You're turning them into bigger plants. You're trying to combo off some things. Some of them have abilities that happen as soon as you play them. Some of them have abilities when you play other cards. It was very inoffensive, and I didn't mind it whatsoever. And the art is amazing. And like you said, the puns bring it all together, and it's a great little fun card game.
I think inoffensive is a good word for it. Most of the abilities and most of the scoring conditions I didn't find especially engaging or clever. What I did quite like and struck me as somewhat novel was the weather system. Every plant will grow if it's provided with the appropriate weather. And there's four different kinds of weather. And there is some random amount of weather that's going to come out from a shared deck, one that you know of and one that you don't know of. And every player puts in a new element. They're all revealed, and that will determine what weather is going to go. But this can be supplemented by one-shot bonus weather cards that you can use just for yourself. And I really liked that element of looking at and seeing what kind of plants to take based on what weather patterns I knew my opponents were playing. I started observing what other people started throwing in and then deciding what weather to throw in myself based on what was already visible and collecting bonus cards, using at the right time. That part I thought was really good.
Yeah, and the fact that you can sort of, like you said, plan your deck out, have your plants all sort of need the same sort of elements so you know.
Or different kinds of elements. I went both ways over the course of the game. Sometimes I piled up on all the same, and sometimes I diversified knowing that whatever came out, I'd be okay.
That is Plantopia, the card game, designed by Daryl Chow and produced by Auragame. I've just got a whole bunch of Twitch stuff. So if you're into dice rolling games, Twitch is the place for you. They do all sorts of roll and writes because everyone can participate. They let you download the sheet, and they work on particular roll and writes, the ones that work with, you know, unlimited numbers, and you take the dice. So I got to play one called Paleontologist, where it was all these bones on sort of a grid, and they'd roll two dice, and one die would tell you what color you could use, because you had three different colors of shapes, and the other die would tell you which particular shape. And you got bonuses if you used all the same color or shape around a bone. It's an interesting little roll and write. We're not big on roll and writes, but as they go, it wasn't terrible. Paleontologist is designed by Joe Holt, and it's just a web publish. He's going to be putting it out as an actual game soon. This is sort of like a prototype or just a sort of demo type game. Other Twitch stuff I played, I've been doing all sorts of unboxing this week. I played Shards of Infinity and sort of put it up against Dominion. Dominion's coming out with a new app. So we played Dominion first. It's Dominion. And then I wanted to show people a far superior game, which is Shards of Infinity, where it just uses everything Dominion did, like the fun parts of Dominion, and just expands on that. In sort of like the Clank type of system where there are different suits of cards and they all sort of combo off each other and you get to, attack your opponents and build up this, you know, your infinity stones and you know, you're either attacking your opponent down to zero or you're slowly building your infinity shards up to 30 and then trying to get that last card out to finish the game.
I agree with you that I prefer Shards of Infinity to Dominion, and it's interesting. I played Shards of Infinity as well, independently, this time the physical version, with the two expansions into it, both of which I think significantly improve the game, the first one especially, Relics of the Future. But they have radically different approaches to combos. And people who really like Dominion really like the way Dominion works. Namely, you look at the 10 cards that are available, you figure out how the card combos are going to work, that guides your purchasing decisions. And then you get to go forth and do that. Shards of Infinity has a much more simple, accessible combo system whereby largely you're encouraged to focus on a given suit sometimes, but that is not even necessary. You know, Dominion, if you just putter along and get random assortments of cards, they're probably not going to work very well together. And at that point, you're probably going to be defeated even by big money. Shards of Infinity, on the other hand, you don't really need to exert those suit bonuses, especially since many cards don't even have any suit bonuses. So you can just, you know, go and do whatever you want to do, more or less. It's a much simpler game. It's a much faster game.
Yeah, the most fantastic part, at least for me, for Shards of Infinity, is the fact that you're working on a certain suit or a combo of suits, and then suddenly the display comes up and there's no cards that you want. And it has this fantastic mercenary system where you can just one-shot one of those cards, get its ability for that turn, and off to the discard pile. It doesn't bog down your deck, nor does it have like any money cards. Well, they do in a way. Some of the, you know,
a fair number of them.
They do,
are
but at least, but at least they have that suit color, so other cards will combo off of it for its suit bonus as well as the money that it gives. So, and a lot of the money cards let you draw another card afterwards, so they're not like bogging down your deck.
So it's weird. We seem to have very different experiences of Shards of Infinity, despite both really liking it. I don't view it as about exerting large quantities of combos. I view it instead about trying to manage a series of effects and trying to build a deck that is able to respond adequately to whatever my opponent's doing. Sometimes I need defense, sometimes I need healing, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I can just go pure offense. Now, part of that, of course, as you say, is influenced by what comes out of the market. And part of that is influenced in turn by what relic I can acquire and or what relic my opponent does. But, you know, in terms of its innovations, I agree with you. The mercenary system is really, really good. You can use a card without it gumming up your deck, and it triggers immediately, unlike just, you know, putting it in your discard pile. It'll show up sooner or later. And the mastery system, which is basically a threshold that various cards have, you know, at 10, 20, 15 mastery, this card will do more things. And shockingly, it is often very, very difficult to decide whether you want to spare that one extra unit of currency to increase your mastery turn on turn on turn. That's the part I really like about Shards of Infinity. The whole mastery system, I think, is really, really well done. And especially since it's pretty much the only, that and the mercenary system are pretty much the only novel thing when compared to all the Realms games, because it's very clearly derivative of that model of gameplay.
I was about to say the same thing. If you ever played Star Realms, this has definitely a feel to it. You sort of throw out all your cards and you develop the two pools. You have your big attack pool and then you have your money pool and you use it however you like. And it also has, in Star Realms, you have these space stations, but in Shards of Infinity, you have these heroes, and they sort of go in your back row, and they'll stay out from turn to turn. And in Star Realms, you have two different types of space stations, ones you have to attack, and ones that you can, in Shards of Infinity case, you can or not. So you can just attack your opponent directly, or they will keep using these heroes over and over each turn, or you can, you know, destroy their heroes.
Champions.
And that concludes our full review of Shards of Infinity. This is designed by Gary Arendt and Justin Gary. Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And published by Stoneblade Entertainment. So to go back to the Dominion app quickly, a lot of people have been playing it. The AI have been crushing them, like doubling the score of any people that try to play it. And the AI goes so fast that you can't see what they're doing sometimes.
Ooh.
And the other thing it doesn't do is it doesn't give you like a scoring synopsis at the end. So you have no idea.
It just spits out a number?
It just spits out the number. This is your score. So wow. You have no idea, you know, how did the AI get to that score? Like how many cards did he have in his deck? How many curses did I have? No, it's just.
Maybe in the first patch, all that will be replaced by is just the sound of the computer laughing at you. You don't even see numbers.
More than likely.
On the topic of deck builders, I got to try the new deck builder by Nigel Buckle and David Tsirtse. This, of course, is following provincial, federal, and international law that all games be co-designed with David Tsirtse. This is Imperium Classics, also following the trend of everything having the word Imperium in it. I am tired of these things, but anyway. Imperium Classics and Imperium Legends are two complementary games. Each of them have 8 different civilizations. I'm a little bit leery about the fact that Imperium Legends has the one empire that is the Far East, namely the Qin Dynasty. So it's kind of sort of, the mystical Orient a little bit. But anyway, in the Classics version, you do have the Persians, so that kind of, it's not purely Oriental. Anyway. Imperium Classics is shockingly pure for a deck builder. You know, we talk about how deck building can be sort of an element in a worker placement engine, such as in Dune Imperium, another game with Imperium in it, or it can actually be a minor part of a much bigger gameplay system like Mage Knight, because I'm contractually obligated to bring up Mage Knight every episode. Imperium Classics is very, very close to being an almost pure deck builder. You have resources that you can accumulate, but only of 3 different types. And everything is pretty much just a function of cards that are in your hand or, in very rare cases, cards that are in your tableau. But the cards in your tableau, you don't tend to have that many of them, and they don't tend to be a particularly pronounced element of what you're doing with yourself. I stress this because the amount of gameplay effect that it's able to leverage, despite that, is quite considerable. There are a number of technical terms about where cards start out, and it's a little bit daunting at first, and the rulebook is not ideal, but you have this possibility of seeing your civilization grow and develop in a much more organic and a much more grounded way than most other Civ-type games involved. What do I mean by this? Well, I've commented in the past that in most Civ games, what you have is, you know, the Roman Empire conquering the Auckland, New Zealand with their tank division that's being backed up by legionnaires or something like that. And it just doesn't make any sense. And everything is acontextual and nothing seems to progress in any kind of sane order. In Imperium Classics, you start out most of the time as what's called a barbarian state. And you primarily are primarily interested in grabbing as much territory as possible. You subjugate some people, you grab some territory. But the most advanced stuff like coinage or democracy or things like that, that's too complicated for you. You don't want to mess with that stuff. You just want to grab more land. At a certain point, though, after you cycle through your deck a number of times, you then shift and become an empire rather than just a barbarian state. And now, getting new territory is much more difficult. Not complicated, just there are fewer cards that can do it for you. And suddenly those cards that got you there, the ones that let you conquer and ravage all over the place, you can't use them anymore. And suddenly that coinage and that democracy that you weren't in a position to use before, suddenly they start looking real good. And this is all done very, very simply. And once you switch to an empire rather than a barbarian state, suddenly you're not just about cycling through your deck and adding in new cards. You're suddenly about cycling through your deck so you can buy these very expensive, very, very cool cards and these resources that you didn't really want to stockpile before. I mean, what? You're a barbarian state. You didn't need to stockpile anything. You just need a couple people here and there, or maybe some brick every now and then, but whatever. Suddenly now you need like 7 brick to buy that really expensive, expensive, fancy thing. And so the way that you get a sense of development in a short deck builder, when compared to, say, a 3-hour Civ game, is really, really quite striking. Now, it is, as I said, it's a bit daunting. There's a lot of technical terminology, and there are some things about deck building that it kind of subverts in a subtle way, and it's not very good at identifying. There are one or two core rules that are buried in the glossary. Not cool. I do not appreciate, especially when that leads me to explain the game incorrectly, and now I'm saddled with what we call the guilt. And the faction variety is really cool. So far, I've played with 3 different factions, the Macedonians, the Persians, and the Vikings. And again, subtle rules changes have massive influence. Vikings especially. Most nations are able to bury cards in what's called the history. They'll score at the end of the game, but they're out of your deck. Vikings don't do that. Instead of something going to your history, it gets discarded. So suddenly that card that other people are buying that says, you know, play this card, do something awesome, and that then it goes into your history. They do as one shots. The Vikings start looking over and say, I can keep doing that every turn? Yeah, I think so. And so you end up with this very difficult to manage deck, but with a whole bunch of powerful effects. Anyhow, that's at least with my experience with the Vikings. I really enjoy it. Downtime is an issue. Box says 1-4, and that's accurate. The solo system is not great to learn the system, but once you're familiar with the game, it moves smoothly enough, which is characteristic of some of the better solo systems as far as I'm concerned. And I've played it with 1, 2, and 3. Probably my preferred player count is 2, because that way I don't have to run the solo system and I have less time to wait between turns. But I gotta say, as far as giving me a sense of a developing civilization and giving me a sense of faction differentiation and showing what the contours of a pure deck builder experience can do, I'm very impressed with Imperium Classics. I don't know how much legs it's going to have, because as I say, it's rather more involved than your traditional pure deck builder, and I don't know if I'm always in the mood for like a 45 to 90 minute pure deck builder experience, but I'm very impressed and I'm looking forward to seeing what some of the more esoteric Baroque civilizations like, say, Shangri-La or the Arthurian legends have to offer.
I definitely want to see this game. Sounds really good.
It's definitely interesting. Again, if you're curious about deck builders and seeing what that engine can do, we've been seeing deck builders ever since Dominion for over a decade do the same kind of thing, or even very similar kinds of things. You know, Shards of Infinity is still basically in the same similar kind of mold. And again, when you look at something like Mage Knight, it doesn't feel a whole lot like a deck builder. It's just leveraging deck building to do something else. But Imperium Classics does really interesting stuff. Well, Imperium Legends as well does really interesting stuff with the formula. And so I'd encourage you to give it a look if you're a little bit tired with the traditional formula that's still like deck builders. That is Imperium Classics and Imperium Legends by Nigel Buckle and David Sirtze, and it's published by Osprey Games.
All right, you and I today played a couple of 2-player games. First one is Let's Make a Bus Route, the dice game, designed by Saatchi and put out by Saatchi & Saatchi. And this is sort of based off their first game, which was Let's Make a Bus Route, which is sort of, you know, flip a card and do what it says. This is roll some dice and do what they say. Followed pretty well the same sort of template. You're picking up passengers, you're planning out your little bus route around the city and dropping them off or taking students to school or parents or elderly or
commuters to work, tourists to famous sites,
while all the while wearing down your tires and banging up your bus and
possibly destroying local infrastructure.
Yeah, a little bit. So what did you think overall of Let's Build a Bus Route, the dice game?
Let's Make a Bus Route, the dice game?
Yes.
I preferred the original version because one of the things that people often point to Let's Make a Bus Route is that it has slightly more player interaction by virtue of the map than your standard roll and write. And at least the deck is going to provide an even distribution for everybody, albeit with different results. The way it worked in the original version was you flip a card and that there's a fixed distribution of cards and everyone's going to have the same total quality and quantity of movement, but at different times. You know, we flip over the black circle and the black circle for you means a certain movement pattern and for me it means something completely different. But by the end of it, we're all going to shake out to the same place. And I appreciated that. It made me feel like it smoothed out the experience. It also cut down on downtime considerably because we all kind of knew where we wanted to go and everyone just drew it and we went off to the races. No pun intended. The dice game, I didn't really feel that the dice added much. And so as a result, it made me feel more like I was doing paperwork again, which is the same downside I always feel with a lot of these roll and rides.
And I feel like it was blanketed out. Everyone sort of, you know, stayed to the same sort of, you know, path, you know what I mean? It was balanced out at the end. You know, you're not.
I felt more pressure in the original version. You know, yeah, to make decisions. Exactly. I can only seek to get points in a serious way from a small number of things. In the dice game, it just seemed like I had more time to do a little bit more of everything.
Yeah, and you can only play two players in the dice game, so there wasn't much interaction on the map whatsoever.
Yeah,
you know, there was a few times I went across a route, but other than that, it really wasn't there. But it wasn't terrible.
No, it wasn't terrible. A tiny bit more interaction than your standard roll and write, a tiny bit better theming than your standard roll and write. And I was a little bit disappointed by the fact that, again, the geographical aspect seemed less important. When the finals tallies came up, I had scored the overwhelming bulk of my points through elements that had almost nothing to do with the map. And that made me feel like I was back to doing paperwork, honestly.
And that is Let's Make a Bus Route, the dice game. Our second two-player game was Nenga Parbat, designed by Steve Finn, published by Dr. Finn's Games.
Okay, I'm going to bring it up because you put an emphasis on doctor.
Waiting for the trigger. Yeah,
look, you're an accomplished troll. I knew you did this on purpose. Don't pretend this was by accident. I looked this up. We talked about this before. His PhD is in philosophy.
It is.
Philosophers don't generally look highly on philosophers who call themselves doctor. I don't know if it's supposed to be a joke. I don't know if this is just some independent nickname. He might have been called doctor before he even started school. I don't know. But if he's calling himself doctor on the strength of a doctorate in philosophy, that's a choice. It's kind of okay. Like, it's kind of legitimate, but it's a choice. Anyway, what did you think of Nenga Parbat?
I remember playing the digital version first, and this is why I picked up this physical version.
You were a big fan of the digital version, as I recall.
I was, and I'm not. I don't understand the disconnect right off our first play. It did not seem the same. It didn't seem as strategic or overall, you know, thinky that it did in the first one. I'm wondering if it was because it was, you know, leaving and coming back to it type thing, so it seemed like a deeper game because it like took long, you know what I mean? So maybe that felt as though there was more there because it, you know, you took a turn a day type thing, whereas right. This was back and forth. It was just like, oh, okay. So what you're doing is that you're, you know, removing animals that all have special abilities and you're putting on your explorers and then you're using the special abilities or not. And you're cashing these animals in for, you know, different or same and scoring a number of points. Things that are interesting in this game are the fact that only there's limited scoring spaces. So if someone takes 5 different animals, then no one can take that particular space. So it's a little bit of a race to get to those spaces. But other than that, I don't think it was terrible. I liked how sometimes you could combo the animal abilities together. I'm wondering if that is more of the game, maybe not scoring the animals so quickly and building up a bunch of them and cycling through a bunch of abilities to, you know, score even more. But I think more plays will let me know.
Yeah, I'd be curious in trying it again because I think that it is possible that the timing elements that I find unfortunate in Nenga Parbat are partially or perhaps even purely a consequence of how I decided to approach the game. Namely, as is my general tendency, I went for the quickest cash-ins possible. And as a consequence, by the midpoint or so, our options just narrowed down to a laser point, which meant that the horizons were so narrow and so limited that I didn't really feel like there was a lot of quality decision-making left. Because most of the good scoring opportunities were gone, so the only possibility to score were very, very, very large numbers of things. So you needed a large number of different animals or a large number of same animals or a large number of contiguous people. But the problem is the game was half gone, so there weren't enough spaces left for huge conglomerations of people. There weren't enough animals of the same type left for a large set of the same. And as far as different animals go, there's only so many different types of animals you can deploy, and all the wilds were gone. So it really felt like halfway through the game was done, and we were still going through the motions and just collecting things. And at that point, it was just penny-ante nonsense. And I find it really disappointing when games evolve in that way. I want the games to evolve organically in a way so that my options kind of expand rather than contract if they are going to change substantially. But as I say, that could just be because of how I decided to play it. I was very intrigued by this possibility that you identify, you know, you collect an animal and at any point during the game, you can exhaust that animal and use its special ability. But once you score it, it's gone whether it's been exhausted or not. So you can't score it and then use its special ability. But again, by the midpoint, I looked around the map and the special abilities just weren't executable. You just couldn't use them because all the preconditions had been basically obviated by our own decisions. So, and I guess what I'm saying is, I'm wondering if clever play or if just play that shows the game to its fullest potential involves taking a more long view of things, amassing larger quantities of goods. Then again, maybe not. I don't know. The only other work by Dr. Finn that I've played is Biblios, which we're not huge fans of, so tough to tell. But it was very, very quick. Visually delightful. I have yet to look up any information about animals in the game with which I'm completely unfamiliar. I'm always happy to go down a Wikipedia dive, even if it's about biology or zoology, which is not exactly some of my favorite fields, but I blame my high school experience.
And that was Nanga Parbat.
Played some more Street Masters. Street Masters has been in almost constant rotation for the past few weeks, which is a testament to our long-term appreciation. It's been out for 3 whole years, which means by now it's a bona fide classic.
I know.
All-time perennial classic.
Here's a throwback for you.
Exactly.
We played Street Masters.
All of 3 years. I've checked my stats. I've played Street Masters about 100 times by now, which definitely shows that I've been getting my money's worth out of the game. And we did something that we used to do in the old days of Sentinels of the Multiverse, which is to say a boss stage combination was destroying us, and so we decided to keep going back until we could defeat it. And so finally, we were able to defeat the Hattori clan in the peer pressure stage with the all-star setup of Natalia, Grill, who's a gecko judoka, and you played Chan Chan, the
the swirling death machine.
The Kung Fu Panda. Which, I mean, you'd only played Chan Chan once before, so it wasn't exactly your perennial favorite, but you did want to go back to her because you felt that you could use her abilities better, and sure enough, you did.
Yeah, it was a combination of her abilities plus her massive, massive hit point pool.
Yes. Well, I think mostly, and this is one of my biases, of course, with respect to Natalia, who was played by Huey, and Grill, and Chan Chan, they all are good at generating and using defense tokens. And I really think that that's the way to go. Most of the characters that I play that where I feel like I'm doing the best or being most effective are certainly the ones that either generate large quantities of defense tokens for themselves, that would be Grill, or are able to leverage defense tokens offensively, also Grill, or in a support characters who are able to distribute defense tokens all over the place, that would be Natalia. And the designer insert is another character. Basically, they're Billy and Jimmy Lee from Double Dragon, but in this case, they're the Sadler brothers in the context of the game. One of them is also very, very good at distributing defense tokens, and he's probably one of my other favorite characters. Anyway, suffice to say, Street Masters continues to please, and it's one of those things where we discover a combination or a boss that's very difficult, and we get intrigued and want to keep coming back to it. I am therefore perhaps very nervous about introducing the group to Recyclord, who, to say he's difficult is a massive, massive understatement. But we'll see. Anyway, we've played a number of games of Street Masters, and that's by Adam Sadler and Brady Sadler and Blacklist Games, and I'm looking forward to the future content that's coming out soon. And those are the games we played this week. On to the news and why it doesn't matter.
I'm going to introduce a new segment this week, Mark, called...
I didn't know you can do that. Did you submit it for approval?
Well, this is no to the news segment. This is not instead of the news. This is as well in the news segment.
This is like an Inception thing, isn't it?
How do you know when a company is swirling the drain? First up, we have.
So this is a new sub segment in the style of Michael Walker's patented "Who asked for this?"
Exactly. Well, I that see. And And oh my God, the death throes are upon us. So Capstone picks up Orleans from Tasty Minstrel Games, which was a huge pickup. And why they would release such a game, I'm not sure, but time will tell. So Capstone will be producing Orleans from now on. It is a fantastic bag-building game with many different ways to play, cooperative, competitive, and huge decision spaces within the game even after that. Check it out if you are so inclined. Second up would be Fantasy Flight Game reskins Battlestar Galactica into an Arkham Horror game. But what I feel they should have done here, Mark, is they really should have picked an IP that they actually had art assets for. You know, that way, I would like to know, after this game is released, if there is a single piece of original artwork.
Yes, they've said that this takes place prior to the events of Arkham Horror, and so it's an all-new cast. Because they've been reusing that cast over and over and over again. The characters that were originally in Arkham Horror and showed up in other games.
Yeah, but they have like 17 other Arkham Horror games that they can pull art from, so...
Well, the only thing that I saw, I have not, of course, consumed a great deal of information about this, given my general distaste for much of Fantasy Flight, my distaste for what they've been doing with Cthulhu-style games anyway, and the fact that I thought the Battlestar Galactica was never very good.
I'm going to say, yeah, this is hitting all the points on this.
But I did happen to see that there was novel character artwork, so they're not being completely lazy with their art assets.
Yeah, well, I saw the layout. It is definitely just a straight-up... I shouldn't say that because I haven't read the rule book. From the layout of the game, it looks as though it's a straight up reskin and Battlestar Galactica. Here we go again.
Well, you know, it's the possibility for an entire new generation of gamers to pretend that Battlestar Galactica is good.
This is what I'm worried about. You know, it's got hype and people, you know, have played it and they enjoy it. But people...
I was just joking. People can enjoy what they like. I was just being a jerk. It was just a sarcastic joke.
I am just worried about it because not only... like
worried
we said,
about it.
Yeah, well, just because not... Well, like I'm always worried is that people's first experience will be this game. And like we said, it's not the greatest of games. Not only that, it is dated. So people who have Battlestar Galactica or have played it in the past and have fond memories of it will now play it again and realize, you know, okay, well, maybe this is not... Not only is it dated, but it is a little weak in many points already.
Well, I think that what is more likely is that people who really enjoyed the Battlestar Galactica game because they enjoyed the show and liked calling people toasters, won't have the same appeal because Cthulhu has now been fully done to death and people still enjoy Cthulhu games. But I don't think anyone is going to approach, what's it called again? Undertow? Not Undertow.
Unfathomable.
They're going to approach Unfathomable and no one's going to be like,
oh my God.
Inconceivable is already taken. No, it's a pun, right? Fathom for...
Yes. Oh, I know what it is.
Okay. Because it takes place on a boat. You get it? Fathom?
Yeah.
Boat? Do you get it, Walker?
So clever.
It's important to me that you get it.
Okay.
I doubt that anyone's going to approach Unfathomable and say, finally, a Cthulhu game. Because that's just not... Meanwhile, when Battlestar Galactica came out, it was, you know, the show was still very popular and people loved the show. And yeah. So I suspect anybody that has Battlestar Galactica is probably going to hold on to it. I think everyone can acknowledge that it has been rethemed to Arkham Horror because that's what they have the license to and that's what they can do and that's what they've done. Not out of any sort of groundswell of demand that this be the new environment that the mechanics be ported to.
Yeah, I'll miss, you know, making the Cylon impressions and all the rest. I don't know if you can make a Cthulhu cultist impression.
That's not bad.
It's not as interesting.
Oh, okay.
And that is Fantasy Flight Games reskin of Battlestar Galactica.
So Phalanx Games, the erstwhile wargame company, who still owes me a copy of Successors 4th Edition, any day now. Any day now. Just behind Plantopia. Their next Kickstarter project is going to be a game called Coalitions. This is going to be a grand strategy Napoleonic game, primarily about negotiation and diplomacy. Sign me up. This ticks all my boxes. Grand strategic Napoleonics, deal making, haggling, light map elements. Oh yeah, I'm so there. Now, of course, I suspect this is going to be very, very far removed from the historical background, which is probably for the best because it designs to be a max six-player game. And if you're going to do a grand strategic game about the Napoleonic Wars with six players, somebody has to be Turkey. And that is not a fun place to be when you are playing a Napoleonic. Someone also has to be Prussia, which is also not a hugely great place to be. You get to be irrelevant for a couple of years, you get to be stomped into the ground, and then you get to show up again at the end of the game. Anyway, I've talked about the difficulty of doing grand strategic Napoleonic multiplayer games before. It's very tough, very tricky. It looks like they're taking a very, very light historical view on the topic, which is probably the best way to do it. And so I'm very, very much looking forward to Phalanx's Coalitions. And when looking up Phalanx's Coalitions, I tripped off of Compass Games Coalition, which is also a grand strategic Napoleonic game. Compass Games is a war games publisher that has produced games of, let's say, varying quality and varying editorial control. Usually their rules are not what you would call transparent, consistent, or complete. And from early reports, that is kind of true of Coalition. But it claims that you can do multiplayer grand strategic Napoleonics in a single evening. So if I ever get a chance, see, I have this vision that in Vancouver, when I arrive in Vancouver, I'm going to find just naturally like half dozen people that desperately just want to play a whole bunch of grand strategic
waiting
Napoleonic
in the airport
wars. Exactly, waiting in the airport. They're going to hold like a picture, and instead of my name, it's just going to be a series of flags, like period appropriate flags of the countries there. So if you ever get a chance, I would very, very much like to try Compass Games Coalition.
So Mark, when looking for things that are interesting in the news, I always see some miniatures that always draw me in, and I feel, okay, maybe this will be the system that will bring me back in, because I used to be a huge miniature gamer, and I'm starting to, you know, the chant goes in my head just like it does for any, you know, 1v-all game that, no, Mike, this is not going to be the one. But anyway, the one studio that brings me in every time is GCT Studios. They have a Bushido game, and,
oh, yes,
and some new figures that just came out for that are amazing. This is a very interesting, you know, small skirmishy type game. If that appeals to you whatsoever, or if you just enjoy looking at really interesting miniatures, then check out GCT Studios.
I'm always on the lookout for new and clever ways to meld existing board game mechanisms, and one of those is trick-taking. Trick-taking is very seldom used as sort of a core engine driving anything else. It's usually done on its own terms. And so when I saw the Board Game Geek preview of Shamans by Cédric Chaboussi, I was immediately intrigued. This is a hidden role, backstabby kind of coalition game that is using trick-taking as its fundamental leveraging asset. And I think this is genius because anybody who's played a lot of trick-taking games, especially when you've had to teach new people trick-taking games, has had the experience. They play a card out of suit. You say, so you're really out of the lead suit? And they say, yeah, I don't have the lead suit anymore. Because sometimes people just make mistakes and they play cards out of suit. Here, my understanding is that if you're a certain role, you can play cards out of suit and claim just to be out of the core suit. And so I think it's great when you can take a common misplay and a social misplay experience that many people are familiar with and make that part of your core intrigue. So it is already out in Europe. It is going to hit English distribution soon, we are told. That is Shamans by Cédric Chaboussi.
And lastly for me, back to miniatures again, Games of Workshop has, you know, put out a new box set for Age of Sigmar called Dominion. It has Hobgoblins and Empire in it. And if this interests you at all, I suggest you get it quickly because they're going to put out a new rule set again, I'm sure, in the next couple of weeks.
Yep. And that is the news and why it doesn't matter. On to our feature game, which is Witchstone. Witchstone was designed by Martino Chiacchiera and Rainer Knizia, distributed by R&R Games, and this is a review copy we received from R&R Games. It was originally published in Europe by Hurgh, which is roughly the sound one makes when being dropkicked in the solar plexus. So, Rainer Knizia has designed one or two games in the past.
Can you list them off for me, Mark?
No.
I've forgotten.
No. I'll list one, actually. Martina Chiacchiera has designed the Deckscape games and the Detective games, neither of which we have any experience with. He's also co-designed Barbarians the Invasion, Mysthea, and Icaon. This is all through the publishing house Tabula. He's co-designed a lot of games, very frequently with his collaborator, Marta Chiacassassi. And it's very unusual for Rainer Knizia to co-design anything. In point of fact, his only other major co-designed release was 2013's Prosperity that he did with Sebastian Bleasdale. Knizia almost exclusively works alone in very much the same way that Martino Chiacchiera almost exclusively co-publishes. It's very strange how some designers seem to gravitate towards that. You know, you think of someone like Kramer or Kiesling, and they almost always co-publish together or with other people. And some people like Knizia just publish by themselves overwhelmingly. And that's a fascinating pattern. So when I saw that Knizia was going to be co-designing a big box game with a designer that has done some interesting stuff, I'm a huge fan of Barbarians: The Invasion or Mystea, but I like some of the stuff that Martino Chiacchiera has done. I was immediately fascinated, especially since anytime Knizia releases a big box game, I'm there. So, Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Witchstone?
Well, Witchstone, the theming is not really relevant. It's kind of boring. So I thought I got a new name for it, Mark. It's called Mega Spin Combo Point Salad. See, doesn't that sound more exciting? So it's what this game is six sort of mini games, and on their own are not only two are actually interesting, but the way they all interconnect and form this like smooth flowing, constantly engaging, light puzzle action efficiency game is really something to experience and witness, Mark.
Witness me, Walker.
So like you said, he lately, probably in the last decade, has just been producing small, lighter games. And the fact that he's this year alone is putting out two large box games is very exciting.
He being Reiner Knizia in this
case. Correct.
Yeah, so it's strange because to a certain extent, Witchstone feels to me utterly unlike any Reiner Knizia game I've ever played before. There's one salient exception, and that's how the action selection mechanism works. The action selection mechanism is almost purely derivative of his 2004 release Ingenious, in that you have these two hex dominoes with two different symbols on them. You place them down, and based on how well you connect them to other symbols, it will generate, in this case, some number of actions. In Ingenious, it just generated points. And other than that, this does not feel like a Knizia design at all. That's not necessarily a criticism. There are good games not designed by Reiner Knizia, and there are good games that don't feel like Reiner Knizia games. But I'm honestly amazed at how unlike the rest of his work this feels. Because as you said, and we'll get into more detail about this later, this is absolutely a point salad game with a series of, I would not say well-connected mechanisms, with a series of six almost entirely separated, with one exception, actions that constantly give you a steady and small drip, drip, drip of point income.
Well, let me go over these actions very quickly because I think they're so basic that it won't take very long. Energy action, which is putting out all these different routes across, you know, the
shared board. Yeah,
the shared board. There's the witch actions, which you're going to move.
Witch actions?
Those actions, the witch ones, the witch or witchy of the witch.
No, witch is on first.
The witches move along the routes that we just talked about, the energy routes. Then there's the pentagram actions, which is whizzing you around this circle over and over again. The crystal actions, because we talked about the main board where you're placing these tiles, they're covered with these crystals that are in your way, and there's a crystal action that what not only lets you move them out of your way, but will also give you more actions as you move them off the board. There's the last two actions, which are very boring, but will bring you the biggest points. There's the wand action, which is simply moving up this track and scoring off of things that you've already done. Then there's the scroll action, which gets you two different kinds of cards, which are the spells and the prophecies. And the prophecies are the big points, usually.
It's strange that you would say that the wand actions get you a whole lot of points. The wand track is the one that we normally ignore, because this is one of the ways in which this doesn't feel like a Knizia game. There are two different tracks. The Pentagon track is basically it's a circular track. You're just racing along and getting minis along the way. And then there's the wand track, which is the trackiest of all tracks that ever did track. And there, half the time it gives you bonus actions, and half the time it gives you these arbitrarily arranged point bonuses. And it never seemed to be a particularly salient
source. It did, but if you look up the wand track, we don't normally go up the wand track, but if you look at the spaces that are further up, there are fairly big scoring points on there.
Yeah, on their own terms, but as compared to, say, the guaranteed 2 points you're going to get every two witch actions, or the 6 point, anyway.
Now, there was the one time you yourself got 12 points off of one wand action, and that was just one space.
It was not off of one wand action. That's ignoring the fact that I'd already had to spend a whole bunch of other wand actions to get there in the first place.
True, but sorry, one space on the wand track.
Yeah, the last space. That's kind of like
it wasn't the last space. There was
yeah, if you just focus on the last space that you get to the track and you say, well, one space gave you all those points. No, you're ignoring all those other spaces you climbed to get there in the first game.
True.
That's like saying that you can crest Everest in one step.
But had you advanced a few more steps, there would have been even more scoring opportunities up there, is what I'm trying to say.
So, yeah, there's points everywhere. Everything you do is going to get you points. And let me use this to circle back to one of my complaints about Witchstone, or rather one of my disappointments. The key difference between Witchstone and Ingenious with respect to tile placement is twofold. There are two key differences. One of them is you trigger clusters rather than just straight lines. In Ingenious, you only get points for off of straight lines, whereas in Witchstone, you get clusters. And number two, there are these crystals that are blocking your path. You're not allowed to place any tiles on top of these crystals. They start off in a certain arrangement. So you need to generate crystal actions to move the crystals out of the way so that you can better optimize your placement actions. That part, I think, is great. It's the kind of spatial puzzle I can get behind. It's the kind of spatial puzzle that interacts with an action efficiency engine. And that part is really, really cool. At a certain point, though, and sometimes that when that point kicks in can be different for different kinds of players and for different kinds of visions, you're just going to be moving crystals around to generate more actions. Witchstone, fundamentally, is a game about generating more actions, especially since no matter what kind of action you're generating, it's going to give you some points. 2 points here, 3 points there, 6 points here, 5 points there. So the part where you're moving things around just to open up your board, that part was really cool, and it made me feel like it was integrating with the rest of the game. The part where you need to worry about getting out a route network before other people block your routes, that part I thought was kind of cool too. A little bit of player interaction, and it was a precondition for a different kind of action. All the other actions, it's just standard point mongering. Just I generate 5 actions here. Okay, well, how many points can I get out of that thing? 3 points on the pentagram. Okay, I'm going to get so many points from that. It's okay. It's fine. It's smooth. It's relatively good going. As you say, you can build combos. This is going to be 2 actions here and 3 actions there and whatever. But at the end of the day, it all ends up feeling samey to me by virtue of the fact that it's all just point salad, point mongering at the end.
It is a lot of just racking up the score and, you know, doing combo after combo. But I think you said there was nothing in the pentagram action. I think there is a little bit there because you are taking those tokens that you can add to your board that will make you combo even more, right? And it will help you fill in the spaces, like say you've blocked something off and now it'll let you, you know, open that up again, maybe if you've placed them in a certain way. And the fact once you've moved the crystals off, you're filling up this bookcase. And the energy action, not only is it opening up spaces for your witch actions, but it's also scoring off the scrolls, because a lot of the scrolls, I think the majority of the scrolls, are to do with your connections.
It's true. Here's the thing. I wish that, and this is what's utterly bizarre, because this game feels an awful lot to me like Bonfire in a number of ways. Bonfire was put out by Stefan Feld not too long ago. I'm not suggesting they're derivative of each other. They clearly were developed independently. But Witchstone, by virtue of the fact that it's, you know, it's got some tracks and you're scoring points for everything, feels to me far more like a Stefan Feld game. Not that Bonfire didn't feel like a Stefan Feld game, but in Bonfire, and this is representative of a comparison with lots of different games, Bonfire, you need to get certain ducks in a row, and then you can do the thing that scores you points. You need to lay the groundwork and set up the preconditions, and then you can do the other action that will score for you. I don't always want that to be the case, but I at least feel like the mechanisms are coming together in a more cohesive way when that is the case. When you talk about setting out a network in Witchstone, and you use that network to then put your witches out of the map, so that's two different kinds of actions that feed in together. Nominally, that's one of the parts that I like. Those two actions are more tightly integrated than almost anything else that's going on in Witchstone. The problem is, and this isn't a serious criticism of how the game works, it's just not necessarily what I'm looking for in a Euro. The network is already scoring you lots of points anyway. Everything you're doing gives you some number of points. So I don't feel like I'm building the network because I need to do that in order to get some other thing. I'm just getting points from this thing, and then later on I'll get this points from this other thing. And that lends to the feeling of sameness and repetition.
Yeah, it's definitely there is a sort of buildup as you get more and more actions, but there's, like you said, there's not a buildup of points. You're not building like this tree of increasingly bigger points.
The only time I ever felt like I had to do this thing in order to accomplish anything exogenous to the immediate points that I was generating was precisely in the context of these scrolls. I kind of liked that too. The way that you get these scrolls, which give you the end game scoring conditions, you have to take actions to acquire them. And it'll say, you need to have connected these areas of the board, or you need to have put witches on these areas of the board. Or your cluster of actions on your own personal board needs to be of a certain size by the end of the game. That was the only time when I felt like I was operating under any horizon past, well, I'll play this tile and generate the largest pool of actions I can take. Because really, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It hardly matters what kind of action I'm generating, so long as I'm generating more.
True. The wand has it a little bit, but it covers the whole gamut of everything. So sort of it feeds into what you said. So it really doesn't matter what actions you're doing. But it does sort of give you that build up, like you'll get points based on how many connections you've made or how many of these certain tokens you have. So there is a little bit of the score build up down on the wand.
You're right. And I should admit, the early wand space, almost everyone gets to the early wand space because, again, everyone generates lots of the various kinds of actions. There's not a whole lot of room for specialization. There's not a whole lot of room for significant player differentiation other than the scrolls. But again, the scrolls just demand you to do specific other things. The first spot on the wand that scores is the number of completed connections you make on the energy grid. But you're already incentivized to fill out your energy grid earlier anyway, because that increases the number of places you can send your witches to with other actions. I just wish the game put more choke points on me like that. We talked before about how games can be too restrictive, always getting in your way, never letting you do what you ever do. You use the term handcuffy. I would just talk about it being restrictive and not open enough. And I would have liked a little bit more friction in terms of having to do things in the right order, having to prioritize things temporally. And on rare occasions, Witchstone does do that. But once you pass those one or two hurdles, or absent those one or two choke points, it's just, well, this placement will give me 7 actions of whatever type, I don't care, and this placement will give me 10 actions of a different type. Oh, okay, I'll take the 10 actions because that's more.
Yeah, that's the, my next point I had was that they are, sometimes there are limitations. They, like you said, they didn't come up very often, but sometimes you would run out of the energy to make the connections.
Yeah, component limitations.
Limitations. I've never had a problem with running out of witches, but once you've removed all the crystals from the map, then you can't do that action anymore. So sort of maximizing into one field is, you can get penalized for sometimes because, you know, all your resource of that particular thing will be used up and now, you know, that network is finished.
It's true. But there's no, you don't really have to feel any sort of serious pain for changing gears. Again, there's no room for specialization in Witchstone because all the actions will give you points one way or the other. That's one of the big problems with point salad games. People deploy the term point salad as a slur, and I kind of agree. Largely because I have yet to play a true point salad game that can really hold your attention long term over lots of plays, because it just lends to this atmosphere of, it doesn't matter what I'm doing, I'm going to get some points out of this at the other end of this action. So I've got 6 different actions in Witchstone. A couple of them feel a little bit different around the contours. And again, I keep emphasizing, I like how the scrolls work. I like how you have this pressure to build up your energy network at the beginning. But past that, every game of Witchstone felt a little bit less of the magic, no pun intended. I don't dislike it by any stretch of the imagination, but it just ends up falling into the same traps that a lot of these types of games do.
It's true, but it does give me that feeling at the end of the game that there's still stuff I wanted to do, right? There's, you know, I wish I could go up those few more spaces. It's not as though you're maxing out all the tracks and you ever run out of everything to do. There's always, I wish I could get that one card, or I wish I could figure out, sometimes there's that puzzle, right? Now, that's what I mean with that. You're always constantly engaged. You're not just, you know, doing your turn and, you know, your next turn's always already ready to go type thing. You're always thinking, well, if I play this one or that one. So you're cycling through your different tiles and figuring out how you can, you know, get the 7 different actions from doing all these different things to get all of those things that you want.
Yeah, the puzzle of how to manage your own personal cauldron of action generation, which I would point out has absolutely zero player interaction, is kind of neat. It's not quite a spatial puzzle. It's not quite a pure efficiency puzzle. It's got a little bit of both. And I did enjoy that. I really do think that this is an interesting evolution of the core Ingenious engine. But again, I don't know that it was leveraged as well as it could have been. I think that the game length is just about perfect. You're right. When it ends, you always feel like there was more that you could have done, and you had to make some compromises on the way in terms of maximizing your score, which is nice. Sometimes when people are really getting into the groove and people are comboing a bunch of different things and generating actions of like four different action types in the same turn, downtime can be a tiny bit of an issue, but the game still moves at a good clip and is very, very fair amount of quality decision making for its length. But again, I just felt that the novelty wore off awfully quick in the way that point salad games often do.
The one way it does feel like a Reiner Knizia game is that the actions are fairly basic and the rules are fairly light, but then, you know, the game goes, the decision space is what is what's going to change up the game.
That's true.
And if you have a memory problem, this game's got you covered. So you've got a cube that you can put on the tile you just placed in case you forget which tile you placed. You have an animal tracker to mark how many actions you've got in case you can't remember how many actions you've got. And you've got another tracker in case you move up the wand, you know, really far, you can put another, you know, tile where you started so you can do the actions in order so you don't forget where you started.
Well, let's not say that you need to have a memory problem in order for that to be necessary. We frequently in games of Witchstone, you have the situation where it's like, okay, I'm generating six witch actions and two wand actions. I do the two wand actions. Oh, these wand actions give me some crystal actions. Okay, fine. Now I've got...
Yeah, I'm saying sometimes it is a lot, but the fact that there's three different areas in which they've got all these different counters to track, I thought it was interesting.
I appreciate the effort.
I do. And then there's the shields. We were talking about the shields. You have the shield that hides your victory point tokens and your tiles. And we felt as though sometimes it was just unnecessary, but I was trying to think today why it would be necessary, and I can see in some cases where it would be. If you can see that your opponent can't do a main action, say they can't do a scroll action, then you can key on that and not worry about taking that scroll action at that point.
Right? Sure,
and just do something else, and then they've drawn that scroll action now. Well, now I'll take it and get the card that I want because they won't be able to play that tile in time.
I think the best virtue of the shields is that they present to you an iconographic representation of the board game map so you can figure out what the scrolls are asking you to do without checking the back of the rule book.
That's what I have next. They have, you know, some stuff on the back, and we weren't exactly sure what all the buildings were, and then we had this very useful map on the inside.
I suppose isn't necessarily a virtue of the screen so much as it is a shortcoming of the main map. Six of one, half a dozen the other.
I think, in all, I think Witchstone is a fantastic game. It is not only one that I'll play, but this is one I'm going to be keeping. It's going to stay on my shelf, and because it's a great sort of, I don't want to say gateway game, but it's one that you can bring out onto the table and people who have played before will not need a refresher. It's straightforward. You know what the actions do. You can get into the game right away. And even if someone hasn't played before, they're going to understand it quite quickly, and it's not a difficult teach.
I'd probably rather play Ingenious. And Ingenious isn't even probably one of the top 30 Knizia games that I like. It's enjoyable. I'll play it again when it's put in front of my face. And it's probably one of the better point salad games that I've played. But point salad games don't hold appeal for me very much. And for reasons that I've articulated. That's going to do it for this week. Thank you very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach Walker via his email, justrolledadice@gmail.com. You can reach me, Mark Bidney, on Twitter, @thegamesyoulike. Join us after the closing credits for our further installment of Swag Presents Masterpiece Theater. For more public discussion, you can find the So Very Wrong About Games Facebook page, or you can check out our Board Game Geek Guild, which is guild number 3236, and you can find us on Patreon and Twitch. We read everything you send us, and we'll get back to you if we can. Thanks again for tuning in, and we hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bigney. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter @sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
So Mark, did you know that street racing doesn't only happen in North America?
Really?
Over in Japan, apparently there is also street racing, and they drift.
Thank you once again for joining us for Masterpiece Theater in honor of Prospero Hall. I have, once again, but two comments about Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift. We are introduced to Han, played by Sung Kang, the coolest bamf I've seen for some time in movies. All he wants to do is snack and crime. But that's okay. I mean, all the protagonists of these movies are criminals anyway. It's almost enough to make up for the negligent underuse of Air Doctor Dr. Vincent Diesel Esquire OBE. 11 out of 10. Mustang update. Walker, did you know that the 1967 Mustang is an ideal drift racer?
Of course it is. It's differential and, yeah, let's stop. I don't think we've talked about that.
We haven't yet.
Are we going to wait or are we going to talk?
No, I think it's time.
Is it time?
The I fact think it's
that,
time.
That throughout all of these movies and right up to the very last 20, not even 20, last 10 minutes of the movie, it's always foreign.
Import Japanese cars.
Import Japanese cars. Nissans or
Mitsubishi.
And then now we need the true power.
Yes.
We will bring in the North American muscle car.
Yes.
And it will win the day for us.
It doesn't matter whether you're drag racing. It doesn't matter whether you're street racing. It doesn't matter whether you're drift racing. Always an American muscle car.
It's the answer to everything, really.
Apparently. It's so bizarre.
When in doubt. And I love the parking system. I love how they showed, you know, the little, you know, the usual nuances of Japan.
Oh, it was a very nuanced presentation of Japanese culture.
Right? Yes. Very subtle.
Extremely subtle and nuanced. Well, thank you very much for joining us for Swag Presents Masterpiece Theaters. Join us next week when numeracy once again reigns supreme, and we will be talking about a sequel that actually has a number in its title. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.